All right. Our next guest here on the Postdoc Way is Dr. Chad Bayer, PhD, MBA. Dr. Bayer is the president and CEO of Promentis Pharmaceuticals. You can find them online at promentispharma.com. He is also a father, golfer, skier, assistant hockey coach, and scientific professional with more than 15 years of experience in development of medications designed to treat brain disorders. So welcome, Chad.
Hey, thanks, Brian. Thanks. It's great talking to you.
Yeah, it's great talking to you. I'm very excited to have you on because of the very colorful background that you have in scientific research. So I wanted to start off by getting a little bit more into your background. So I was hoping maybe you could describe briefly what your background is and describe, you know, some of your current occupations.
Well, as I told you before, when I write down my occupation, whether it's for, you know, tax purposes or whatever, I tell people I'm a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
I have a PhD in neuroscience, which really actually is a PhD in pharmacology.
Okay.
But we focused on neuroscience and neuropharmacology, and I got that at LSU in Shreveport, Louisiana, and that was many years ago. And that was my first entrance into understanding how the brain works normally, and not that we completely understand it today, but that was sort of the genesis of me saying, wow, this is really a cool place to work.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of research. And so then I went, I got my PhD from LSU, and I got, you know, you're going to hear this a lot. I was at the right place at the right time.
Of course.
And so I don't know how you teach that to people. I don't know how you mentor that to people. But without a doubt, chance favors the prepared mind.
Right.
You know, being out there, being in motion, being engaged, I think is the only way to be when you're looking for, you know, work, or you're looking for something for your next hobby or interest, from a career perspective or from any perspective. But I was at the right place at the right time, and we had the seminar speaker from Wyeth Pharmaceuticals come down.
Mm-hmm.
He was a friend of somebody in the department. He came and gave a seminar, and like any good, his name is Jim Barrett. He's just a super nice guy.
Okay.
And like any seminar speaker, they eat lunch, you know, the worst pizza that they can find. and they serve it to this poor guy and all of the students. And so we were having lunch with him, and I, you know, took a chance, gave him my resume. I was starting to get to that process of almost writing and getting towards the end of my career.
Mm-hmm.
In graduate school. And it was clear to me that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to go make drugs. I wanted to go into the pharmaceutical industry. I wanted to help people. And I thought, geez, you know, I'll never hear from this guy, but hey, I'm going to give him my resume. And 2 weeks later, I got a call from somebody within his organization in the CNS group. And
mm-hmm.
I was, you know, I skipped the postdoc. I went immediately from graduate school to a full-time position at a large pharmaceutical company. Working on really cool drugs. And so I was involved with a lot of drugs that never made it to the market, but our lab also was investigated some of the properties of Effexor, Prestige. These mm-hmm. are two blockbuster, multi-billion-dollar drugs, antidepressants. And so I was there. That's how I got my start. At some point, I did an MBA part-time while I was also doing some science.
Sure.
At Wyeth and running a group, and I was there for 10 years.
Hmm. Okay. So backing up just a little bit, was there a particular inspiration that kind of catapulted you to pursue a higher education in academia?
You mean the PhD work or an MBA?
To continue on. And go to graduate school, because a lot of people, I mean, they kind of hit a wall. They have two or three decisions in front of them. One is to continue on and go and pursue a PhD in higher education, in academia. Two would be enter the workforce, or three would be to do something completely different. And I'm curious, was there a particular moment that inspired you to go ahead and apply to graduate school?
Brian, I wish there was. I wish I was smart enough to point out a moment and say, yeah, you know, there was. I went to college. I went to a small liberal arts school just north of Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And south of Lake Erie. and a school called Allegheny College. And that, like most small, you know, 1,500 students campuses, basically set you up for more schooling. You know, most of the folks there were there for 4 years and then went to medical school or went to law school or went to graduate school. So, you know, there wasn't a moment where I thought, geez, it just was something that was very natural. Mm-hmm. And just, this is what people did. And so I sort of followed that trend. I will say that I had aspirations. I mean, I was a math major when I went to college. And I was like, in love with math. I really liked, I just like the strategy of it. I just like trying to figure this stuff out. And then math got really hard in college. It wasn't numbers. I mean, it was images and fractals. And it didn't look like math to me, but it was. It was just, you know, advanced math. It just got really hard. And so I had taken a lot of science courses. I had taken a lot of physics courses associated with the math curriculum. I had taken a lot of some chemistry, some biology, sure. You know, really rounding out a scientific background. And, you know, I don't know who goes to college and who's, you know, 19 or 20 years old who says, oh, I really want to do X, Y, or Z. I just didn't have that. And I sort of fell back on when I got when I realized that I couldn't do math like I should and, you know, what was I going to do? I had taken enough science courses mm-hmm. and psychology courses and pharmacology. And, you know, I'm old enough. I'm not that old, but I'm old enough to admit that back then they didn't have neuroscience courses. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they had one. And you know, but there wasn't a major in neuroscience. And I would say now, I know Allegheny does have a neuroscience program. I know a lot of colleges do. I would say now that as I look back on the curriculum, the mixture of science and chemistry, biology, physics, and then the pharmacology classes. I mean, I was a sophomore taking courses with seniors who were taking these advanced pharmacology courses. And I don't know how I got in there. I really wasn't that smart. I think a lot of it came down to my mentorship and my advisor putting me in there. He taught the course. He says, you should take this if this is what you're interested in. And I did.
Yeah.
And I suspect that that's really what the neuroscience program is now, mm-hmm. right? A little bit about about the brain, a little bit about how drugs work in the brain, chemical neurotransmission. That's all the stuff I learned, but in bits and pieces. And so, I just kind of fell backwards into it. And then at the graduate school, again, with the help of advisors and mentors. That's one critical thing I can't stress is that I've always had, I think, a good relationship, or at least picked people that I have, you know, interacted well with as mentors.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or advisors, you know, and you pick somebody in college, or he and I are still friends today.
That's great.
And my graduate school advisor, he and I are still friends today. Mm-hmm. And I know his family, he knows mine, and I think that's sometimes rare that you, particularly in academics, I mean, that was always sort of what people would tell you, that, okay, listen, you're going to know you're done with school when you and your advisor actually fight, like physically, you know, fight, right? You know, that's when you know you're done.
Right.
And that usually takes 6 or 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so my advisor and I just never got to that. Oh, I think I was very productive. I think he appreciated it. I certainly appreciated his advice and mentorship and sacrifices for me to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, hey, I did this, I did that, what's left up, it's this, and it was easy for me.
That's really impressive. Like you said, that's not always common. I think especially in larger labs, there's a little bit of a separation between the trainees and the PI, I mean, for good or for bad. So I'm curious now, too, at some moment you decided that you weren't going to stay in academia and you didn't want to become a PI. So I assume some of this came from, or I guess the comfortability to approach this subject came from your interaction with your PI and your mentor. And so I'm curious if you can elaborate on that moment when you actually told this to your PI, or was this something he started to suspect after a while and maybe helped shepherd you into the next phase?
I think he suspected it. I will say down at LSU at the time, and we had a few students, not a lot, but a few students that were graduating ahead of me, and that had, obviously, a ton of them have graduated and went on to postdocs and more the traditional postdoc
route. Sure.
There were a couple that had graduated and got full-time jobs. Most of them were at various contract research organizations. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't uncommon or out of place for somebody to say, hey, what's Eric doing? He's over at this company and you know, he didn't do a postdoc, or he's doing a postdoc in the industry or something.
Sure.
So when I approached my advisor, you know, and said, hey, I'm going to apply for this position here and there, I don't think he was surprised. You know, I think he was very supportive. Maybe enough time has gone by. Maybe, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, whenever it was, maybe he wasn't, but I honestly believe he was. And I honestly believe that he also mentioned, look, you should consider doing postdocs. I mean, he did and said all the right things. If you're interested in this, that's great, but here's a couple other things you should consider. I interviewed for one or two academic postdocs. I interviewed for one or two positions, one at Wyeth, which I ended up mm-hmm. taking, and one at another pharmaceutical company, a CRO company, rather.
Sure.
So, I always sort of had that bug and that drive. I'd be lying to you by if I didn't say, you know, some of it, look, when you're a graduate student making, you know, some ridiculous stipend of $1,000 a month, and you're, you know, you're pulling in a whopping 12 grand a year. That's what it was back then. I think when I graduated, it was up to 15 grand a year or something.
Sure.
You are somewhat motivated by money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the opportunity to interview for a postdoc that now is going to pay you $36,000 a year or something like that, which sounds great.
Right.
You know, it's a tripling of what you're making. But when you go out and you start talking to people, and if you're in a fortunate situation, you get an offer, you go, wow. why would I turn this down? it's six times more than what I'm making. I'd be lying to you if some of it wasn't motivated at that time when you're, you know, 25 years old or whatever by money.
Sure.
To start a family, to mm-hmm. start a life, and you know, you sacrificed, you went to college. You know, you're high school for 12 years, college for 4, graduate school for 5. I did an MBA, took 4 years part time. I don't add that up. It's like 25 years in school. So, you know, at some point you can't stay in school forever.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to get out. So that was some of the motivating factors as well.
Sure. Were there any additional resources that you used other than the speaker that you mentioned came and gave a seminar from Wyeth? Were there career counseling advisors, or were there other seminars or conferences dedicated to exploring additional career options outside of academia? Or was this, like you said, you might have alluded to this before, as being in the right place at the right time?
There probably was. I mentioned to you earlier, I have an adjunct faculty position mm-hmm. at Thomas Jefferson. And I know today, I my memory is a bit foggy from back then. I'm sure LSU had, or certainly has, a career office. I know Jefferson does as well, and mm-hmm. I work closely with these people just because we're all friends. And you know, I still think there's absolutely no substitute for networking and for putting yourself out there and interacting with people. And if you want to interact with other academics and other, you know, people who are PIs, then that's what you should do. If you want to interact with people who are doing, you know, CRO work, you should interact with them.
Sure.
You should, you know, exclusively do that. But I really just network with people that were working in industry
mm-hmm.
because that's what I wanted to do.
Right.
I think I sort of interacted with a lot of people. But I think it really comes down to networking. And I tell the people at Jefferson this too. It's, you guys can help. But it comes down to the faculty members and mentors having a network of people to say, you found a job online at, you know, whatever company, we call it Merck.
Mm-hmm.
Well, great, apply online. And I suspect that if you apply for a job at Merck in New Jersey, I suspect that their resume database is located somewhere in Iowa.
Sure.
Because that's just, you know, some data, you know, mainframe somewhere. And I suspect that nobody in New Jersey will probably ever see that resume.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe. But I think what's better is, oh, really? What's the job number on that? You could figure out what department it is based on the job description.
Mm-hmm.
And if I know somebody in the cardiovascular group at Merck, and that's what this position is, I may not know the hiring manager, but I bet I know somebody who does.
Sure, exactly.
And so now just a simple email of, hey, listen, Jerry, you know, I've got Brian's resume here. Nice guy. Mm-hmm. I've known him for a while. He's interested in kind of getting his foot in the door. Could you pass this resume on to this person who's hiring for this specific job? I really appreciate it. But, I mean, that's the best currency mm-hmm. that you have by networking with the right people.
Right.
I think by and large how it works is networking with the right people. I didn't get anybody a job. I mean, you still have to go through the phone interview. You still got to go and spend 2 days interviewing for 8 hours and go to dinners and give a seminar perhaps and, you know, do all these things. But at least they saw your resume.
Right.
If you send it to a database, if you send it blindly apply online, you know, I don't think you're hedging your bets well enough to get it across the desk of the right people. That's my opinion. That's been my experience. I can almost guarantee you there are exceptions to that rule of people that have applied to a job online ultimately got the job. But I think it's rare.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree with you. I can say that's been my case as well, or my experience as well. And one of the numbers that I keep hearing or that I keep seeing appear in these conferences I put on is greater than 90% of the jobs that are obtained are through networking. And that suggests indirectly that a lot of the jobs that are available are usually not posted online. They're through interacting with individuals and somebody, like you said, passing a resume on or keeping a resume for a few weeks when they know a position is going to open up, and all of a sudden you become that preferred candidate or that referred candidate. And I think that, you know, there's no substitute for interacting with individuals in the career path or the field that you would like to follow in. I think that's, you know, you highlighted that beautifully. I think that's extremely important.
And I think it's too important too, because you don't know, even if you know somebody, you mm-hmm. know, maybe you want to work in somewhere specific, you know, part of the country.
Right.
So you have a real affinity for some sort of geography. And then from there you work at the companies, you know, you look in the companies that are in that particular geography.
Exactly.
And so then if you're even able to reach out through your network, through your friends and family, and you may put your resume on a desk of somebody who's not hiring now, but might be in 3 months
exactly.
or 6 months.
You're completely.
You know, it does come down to being at the right place at the right time. And I'll tell you, when I went to Wyeth out of graduate school, mm-hmm. I would say I started in December of 2000.
Okay.
And I am pretty sure by April of 2001, there was a hiring freeze, which meant no matter how good you were, no matter who you were, this is very common in any company, big company. I mean, it's like, hey, you know, we're having trouble. First quarter was a little low. We got to save a little bit of money. Second quarter, hiring freeze. You know, that usually does the trick if it's a small amount of money that you're trying to save. And I remember thinking, well, geez, if that one experiment that I did in graduate school didn't work, and, you know, we did chronic repeated dosing type studies, that 14-day study I would have had to repeat, and that would have taken a month, and then maybe that would have worked out a different way, and then I wouldn't have given this guy my resume, and then I would have, it just comes down to timing, being at the right place at the right time.
Right, right, yeah.
And the guy who ultimately hired me left for another job. He was British, and him and his wife had kids, and they were trying to move back closer to their family. In fact, mm-hmm. they're still there today. And that position above me remained open through that hiring freeze.
Wow.
And that hiring freeze was a little unusual because it lasted for well over a year. And now we're talking about the end of 2001, which also included September 11th.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there was just a lot of stuff going on. And then you get to the end of any fiscal year for any company, and, you know, mine's a little tight. You know, and then all of a sudden, now it's the next year. That position's been empty for almost a year. I've been there now for 2 years, and so I was at the right place again at mm-hmm. the right time. I really, it's not, nobody gives you these things. You have to work hard. You have to go and show that you're able to sort of walk the walk when you need to and do these things. And you have to have the scientific chops to step into a position that I had stepped into simply because there was a hiring freeze.
Yeah.
Now, I know if there was a hiring freeze, they would have wanted to replace that guy because we interviewed a bunch of people. It's just how it works out sometimes. And you won't ever, you can't plan for that. You can't advise students for that other than to say network, 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 and stay in motion.
Right.
Because, you know, I'll say again, chance favors people that are in motion.
Right. Yep. That's very, very well put. I'm curious if you can elaborate on this as well. You spent some time, like you mentioned, at a pretty large pharma company, Wyeth, and since then you've gone on to explore some other options. As I mentioned, you're the CEO of Promentis now. So I'm curious if you can kind of compare and contrast a day in the life of somebody at Wyeth versus somebody in your position currently, and maybe highlight some of the positives and the negatives of both.
I want to get a coffee mug or a t-shirt that says hashtag. I love what I do day to day. The company's fabulous. The board is fabulous. And oh, by the way, it's really cool and innovative science, but it's just, again, going back to working with people that you like and that you're comfortable with and that they're comfortable with you is important because that's what we do. We spend all of our days interacting with people, and it can be a giant pain in the butt if you're not liking who you're talking to on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
So let me tell you a little bit about a day in the life of Promentis, and then I can compare and contrast that to a larger company.
Sure.
Again, very much at the right place at the right time. Our former CEO, Dan Lawton, let me take a little bit of a step back. I mean, Promentis was started out of Marquette. Two scientific co-founders, David Baker and John Manch, had some really cool science that they were doing in their labs. Folks like Tim Keen and the Golden Angels Network figured this out, recognized that it was cool science, and started pulling, you know, funds in a team and talking to more people. I mean, it does take a village. It's not just one person. And so you have the Golden Angels, you have the scientific founders, you have this amazing group of people that came from Schwartz Pharma, before it was sold, after it was sold rather to UCB, and folks like Klaus Leidinger and Dan Lawton. I mean, we all pulled together just the best team and formed this company around this really cool science. And so in a small company, and you're absolutely right, I mean, I've worked at a company that has 70,000 people, and worked at a company that has 7.
You're right.
And I can tell you that the company that has 7 does not have the bandwidth to have all of the pieces covered all of the times. But typically a company like Pfizer or any big company would. You know, if you need to deal with the government, well, you hire a bunch of regulatory people. You need lawyers, you hire a bunch of lawyers. I mean, every one of those companies has a ton of lawyers. You need to do science, what do? You hire a bunch of scientists. You just can't do that in a small company. And so I'll never forget my first day on the job as CEO. I came in, and there's a dry erase board, and the old CEO that I mentioned to you before, Dan Lawton, is an incredible human being and just the kind of guy you want to meet and have as a mentor, wrote on the board, "Congratulations, see pile of papers on the desk." Okay? I walk over to the desk and I see it was, I don't know, 7-8 inches high, nothing crazy, but, you know, a good stack, a meaty stack of papers. And I sit down and I roll up my sleeves and I look at the top stuff, and it's a folder titled, you know, intellectual property structures of interest. And you're like, wow, you're flipping through. Okay, these are, you know, when you sell any company, whatever your idea is, you're selling a patent.
Right.
You have an idea of the patent, and that's the currency that you're trying to lure over investors. That's the currency that you ultimately sell and do a deal. So this is the mother lode of what we're about at Promentis. And I'm flipping through, and it's chemistry, and this is an important folder. Let me put this aside. I'm gonna read that a little bit later in more detail. Next up, big folder. I mean, 2 inches thick of invoices. Pay the phone bill, pay the electric bill, pay this, pay rent, pay, you know, invoices for scientific chemicals that we're using in the lab. I'm like, okay, I got to call the bank and get this done. All right, we'll do that. So there's a bit of the next folder is science, really cool articles, biomarkers and things about schizophrenia and okay, how glutamate, you know, oh, these are really good. I totally got to read these later. You know, these are really good papers. And then I go in, and then there's a folder about some of the employees and some of the just the general workings of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, that's the circadian nature of working in a small company. You know, you toggle through, and I'm going to throw out what I toggle through, but you'll do this at a small company. You toggle through law, intellectual property around what your ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Are they covered? Are they nationalized? Are there costs associated with maintaining them? Yes. The answer to that is always yes. Do you want to patent it? Do you want to turn a provisional and convert it into a full-blown? There's a lot of legal stuff. And we have a great group of folks that we work with down out of Chicago, Wood Phillips. But you still have to think about it day to day. You still have to look at it. So you toggle back and forth in your mind between IP, some business development. I mentioned to you earlier, next week we'll be presenting to the Golden Angels. We're in the midst of a Series B round of investment. So you're doing business development. You're doing investment. You know, you're paying some bills. And you're doing science. You're doing drug development. And just when you get all the way through all of those five or six things, you hit repeat and do it again. And you just keep doing it until you're successful at getting where you want to go. So that's the day in the life of me at Momentus, and I think a lot of people at a small company. You do a lot of different things. You know a lot about a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, maybe going back to graduate school, and to what we talked about just a couple minutes ago, that was always something that I liked.
Right.
I liked the idea of learning a lot about a lot of things. I didn't want to be, and this is me, and there's nothing wrong with people who don't want this, or people, look, most people would have ran out of that office when they saw that stack of papers and said, I understand the chemistry stuff, but well, what's up with all this other business development? What's up with all this IP stuff? What's up with all this? Most people would have went running. Mm-hmm. And I rolled up my sleeves even further, went over, made a pot of coffee, because you do that as well as you know, in a small company, you take the trash out when it needs to be taken out. You make coffee when it needs to be made. And I got a cup of coffee, and I sat down, and I just couldn't be happier. And I haven't thought about it since. And I can tell you that every other week is just like that. It's a 2 to 3 week cycle, I think, of going through. And the moment you stop and say, oh, cool, I can take the day off, there's something to do, you have a problem, because there is something to do. There's probably something that needs your attention. And so that's why it's fun to me, and that's what I've always sort of been driven to do. And I like to think that everything that I've done in my entire life and everything that you've done, it's training us to do something. Yeah, I've been training my whole life for this role. I mean, I pay my bills at home on time. You know, you have to manage money. You have to manage your time. You have to be a mentor to your kids or to people. You know, you have to you do all these things every day in a job like this. And so it's a lot of fun. Now, conversely, at a big company, like I said, they hire people to do business development. They hire groups to do law. They hire a regulatory person. They hire scientists. So if you're a scientist and you have an idea, what do? At a big company, you call, you know, you pick up the phone and you say, hey, Bob, you know, hey, this is Chad over in the R&D group. I have an idea. Can we patent it? Thanks, Bob. You know, just call me whenever you need my signature. And that guy, one, he never sends you an invoice because you're all on the same team. And two, he goes off and he does all of the freedom to operate, and he tries to figure out if your idea is patentable and blah, 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 blah. And then somebody comes by and says, hey, we need your signature on this. It's, hey, great idea. Thank you. High five. Keep it up, and we'll see you when you have your next idea. But in a small company, when you have that idea, it's going to cost you money.
Mm-hmm.
And in a small company, if you don't have one, I mean, it's a constant trade-off between capital and ideas and science and that strategy to navigate through those sometimes treacherous, but sometimes calm waters is I think the fundamental difference between a big company and a small company.
Right.
You wear a lot of hats at a small company, and at a big company, you wear probably one, maybe two, depending on your role.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you're the CEO of a large company, maybe you're the CEO of HP or Hewlett or Pfizer or whatever big company. I mean, those folks are doing a lot of things as well. But if you're a PhD scientist at Merck, you're probably spending a lot of your time in the lab and thinking about science. And you're probably not thinking about, who should I contact in the investment community about a Series A funding round for my idea? I mean, that never happened. unless you're thinking of going rogue and starting your own company.
So. Exactly.
Out of your garage or something. So does that, I mean, maybe that's some sort of insight into my soul about what I like to do. And mm-hmm. I feel like that this wasn't something that I just started feeling about, you know, a couple months ago or a year ago. I mean, this was something in graduate school that I noticed within myself. I like to be learning about a lot of things, involved in a lot of different projects. I like when things go fast. I suspect when I'm 90 or 80 years old, I might look back and say this differently, but I like when things go by quickly.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, you go, wow, look at this list of things to do that you accomplished today.
Right.
That's awesome. But like I said, when I'm 80, I'm sure I'll want everything to go as slow as possible. But
yeah,
again, maybe some more window into my soul.
Yeah, have it catch up to your age a little bit more. So, Was this one of the motivating factors for why you went on and got your MBA as well? I mean, you were interested in it sounds like becoming more than just a bench scientist, and you wanted to get more clear picture of, you know, some of the fields around you or the importance of the fields around you. So was this one of the reasons for pursuing an MBA?
Yeah, great question. And you know what? Of the few questions you've asked about, hey, was there an aha moment? This one there absolutely was. I had two projects when I first started at Wyeth back mm-hmm. in 2000. One of them was the extended release formulation of Effexor, which also involved Prestique.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we got a compound already on the market. Pretty sure it's going to do this. Go ahead and test it. I mean, they didn't say it that way, but it was pretty straightforward. 15 years of chemistry earlier and prior to me starting there, meant these guys knew how to make this drug and they knew how to do this after all years. And then the second project I worked on was a cool drug that was ultimately positioned for cognitive decline for Alzheimer's patients.
Hmm.
And so I had these two projects. Cool. Did the same kind of techniques. I mean, I didn't do anything different for the blockbuster multi-billion-dollar potential drug that I did for this unnamed, basically known only as a number, compound. But when you presented the data, I would go to the team meeting, and that's another thing I also knew about myself early on. That I really enjoy working with people. Mm-hmm. I enjoy working on a team, I should say. I enjoy brainstorming. I enjoy sitting down over a cup of coffee and saying, holy crap, let's see where we can take this intellectually. And so, not that that doesn't happen as much in an academic setting, but I think a lot of that thoughtfulness is put on, the onus is put on the PI.
Right.
And they have to do all of that thinking and all of that by themselves, and that just, I like to do it with other people. And so, I go to the first team meeting with Compound X, and I present it, and there's like five people in the audience, which was perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
There was a chemist who made it and somebody else from his lab or her lab, and there was the project team leader. There was a biology person. There might have been two other people who did some in vivo work and in vitro work, and it's five or six people. And it was cool. Hey, this is what we found. This is what we did. Okay, next compound, please. I'll sit down. That was it. Next day, same presentation, but extended release formulation of a multi-billion-dollar product.
Mm-hmm.
That room was full of people. There were chemists. There were biologists. And I'm not talking two or three. I'm talking 10 of each.
Wow.
And there were, lawyers, commercial people. The head of R&D was there. To say that there were 50 people is probably a slight exaggeration, but there were certainly 25 or 30 people.
Mm-hmm.
Same technique. Same strain of animals, everything was the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to understand, and I think, today it's very obvious, but when you're in that situation of presenting, I'm like, well, where were all you guys yesterday? When I presented to the other, there was nobody here. And I wanted to understand that, and I wanted to understand the business behind doing science.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to have an MBA, I don't think, to figure all this out. If you're investing about $1 billion, which I think is probably a fair and almost accurate statement about what big companies spend to develop a single drug, if you're spending $1 billion, again, you do your own checking account at home. If you have to spend this much to basically, you know, not make that back? I mean, how often are you going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Not very often. You don't have to have an MBA to say, well, targeting some, you know, rare and orphan indication where you get $200 million of return back for a $1 billion investment is not the best investment.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to think that it is. I happen to think that you diversify your science. Big companies need to diversify, and I think they're doing this. They're trying to. Where you do work on blockbusters, but yet you do work on these rare and orphan diseases.
Sure.
And I'll tell you why in a second. But I that to me was fascinating. I wanted to understand not only what these people all did, but why they were there, and really wanted to understand the business behind the science we were doing. The science that you learn as a graduate student, the basic fundamental science. It could have been any young PhD student up there in front of all these people, and it really had nothing to do with me or our lab. It was just the business potential of this drug was just huge,
right.
And I wanted to understand that. So then I started to apply to look at, and this was a long process. I mean, it took a while to warm up to this idea, you know, and at the time I had a family and I was, you know, it wasn't just a decision that I was going to make it. Hey, by the way, I'm going to go to work at 7 a.m. I've got this commute that you and I just talked about before. I've got this crazy commute into Princeton. I'm going to work until 5. And afterwards, I'm going to go grab McDonald's and I'm going to run up 40 miles further away from home and sit in class for 3 hours and learn about economics and learn about accounting and learn about supply chain logistics. And then I'm going to come home around 10:30 at night, and I'll probably stop at that same McDonald's on the way home because I'm still kind of hungry at that point. And oh, by the way, my blood pressure is going to go up over all of this because I'm not eating right, and I'm certainly not exercising. Probably going to put on 20 pounds. And when I get home at 10:30, I'm going to be tired, and I'm going to do it again tomorrow, and I'm going to do that for 3 years. So, it wasn't fun, but I really enjoyed what I was learning, and I really think it was valuable. And I probably would have changed a few things, but I certainly would have continued to do this. So that's there was a moment where I said, man, I want to understand this. I want to do an MBA. I want to understand.
Yeah. I think that takes a lot of initiative to actually follow through with it as well. On top of, you mentioned you were doing this at nights, so this was in addition to working. So I think you really have to be able to balance your work life, be able to multitask and really kind of organize what you need to get done each day. And I'm curious if I was to guess, I would say this might be one of the more important skills that you picked up in graduate school, maybe the organization skills or maybe the project management. So I'm curious, is this... Would you agree in terms of the valuable skills that you picked up in graduate school, or I guess even on the job, what would you say is one of the most valuable skills that you have picked up in the past, you know, 5-6 years?
There is no substitute for experience and doing something. Now, you know, if you're a graduate student listening to this, or somebody going, "Well, geez, no kidding," well, how do I get experience without, you know?
Sure.
I'm trying to do that. You know, everybody. That's the conundrum that we all face. But once you get your foot in the door, even a toe, you have to run as fast and as hard as you can. I think. I mean, in terms of learning, you know, you have to be engaged as much as possible. And I'm a firm believer. That if you really focus on what's in front of you, 100%, like immediately in front of you, that things will probably sort themselves out the way they're meant to be sorted. In other words, if you're focused on, if I would have been focused on, geez, that guy who hired me, his office is open. Man, how do I get into that office? To be honest with you, I don't really remember it crossing my mind because they had just hired me and I was just in graduate school and I really wasn't suited for that role at that time because I was, I don't know, 26, 27, I was a kid. And it never dawned on me, but I focused on what was in front of me, 100%. And buried my head in it and somebody fired me, tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, by the way, why don't you move into that office? You've been doing a good job. And they're like, oh, okay. Okay, well, cool. I have a new place to sit down and focus on what's in front of me. And that's, you know, I guess the one piece of advice I would have and what I think I learned early on and that I still do now. I mean, you just have to focus on what's in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Not like with Parmentis. Well, geez, what if we're really successful? We could sell in this exit and, you know, this multiple. And yeah, guys, this is a fantastic conversation. I really am getting goosebumps just thinking about it. It's great. But I'm going to go ahead and I'm gonna go back and focus on what's immediately in front of me.
Right,
we can't get there unless we do this. And it's easy to be seduced by those things down the road, whatever it is. I mean, mm-hmm. It's easy to, you're in graduate school, to be sort of seduced by a paycheck that might allow you to buy a house or, you know, it's like, I just think that, you know, once you have some basic needs met, and you can really focus on 100% of what's in front of you, whatever that is, you'll be better off. And I mean, that's advice for every, I mean, I tell that to my 9-year-old when he goes out to skate in hockey. Mm-hmm. Buddy, focus on this practice right now. Don't worry about the game Saturday. Right. And don't worry about your homework right now, because in an hour and a half from now, we'll be focused on that, and we won't be worried about hockey. Mm-hmm. Whatever is in front of you. Dig in, be engaged, ask questions, learn it, and know it, and be able to teach it to other people, I think it would be. From there, things just have a way of sorting themselves out.
Sure.
That's my advice. I mean, maybe some people are a bit more heavy-handed, and they can't force things to work out, but mm-hmm. it's just been one of those things where you got to want to do what you do.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with Parmentis. They're long hours. It's not a job. It's a lifestyle. It's mm-hmm. a life. It's, you know, it's always there. So it's which makes it a lot of fun. It's part of the family.
Yeah. So if you were an academic advisor and you had a student or a trainee that was interested in breaking in to industry, making the transition out of academia, what kind of advice would you offer them, taking into consideration your experience?
You know, I would network with people who, and if I was an advisor who didn't have access to people in industry,
mm-hmm.
I would try to help that person interact with other faculty members who had connections in a pharma or biotech company. I would send them to meetings where people like biotech and pharma folks go and rub elbows with them and have a cup of coffee with them, because that's going to help down the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, well, look on their website and see if they're hiring isn't really helpful. It's something to do on the weekend with a glass of wine at night, you know, and do and spend 3 hours, you know, roaming around the internet.
Right.
But that's a component of it, but I don't think it's a huge component of it. And so I think that my advice would be to do, I mean, get out there and do that. And I'm in a situation where I think I could offer, let me introduce you to this person if that's what you're interested in. The other piece of advice, I have a really good friend of mine from college. she went a better route, more traditional route, I should say. Did a postdoc. I think she actually did 2 postdocs after we both graduated. We went to the same college. We went to different graduate schools. We stayed in touch. And at some point, she said, hey, there's a postdoc position at Wyeth that's available. And I said, give me a resume. I put it on the guy's desk. She got hired. And she didn't like it. It wasn't for her. You know, she was a PI. You know, she is a PI now. You know, it was a lot of things, and I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, but she got there and spent 6 months and said, Chad, thanks. I'm not feeling this. And so it's not for everybody. You know, so if I was an advisor, the one size fits all approach is not going to work for all of your students. You got to know your students. It's a personalized approach, kind of like medicine is, you know, trying to go towards, you know, not everybody responds to the same drug, even though they have the same cancer or the same other, you know, disease.
Right.
And so you have to sort of do a semi little biopsy of this student and see what they might respond to, what their goals are, how are they going to need to be treated, and where they want to be, and then work and tailor something to them. And this was a great example of somebody who thought they wanted this, which I thought she did the right thing. She didn't get a full-time job. She did a postdoc.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And to see if she was, you know, see if she would like it. She's now a faculty member at some small school just outside of Philadelphia, teaching, you know, classes, writing grants. She didn't have them. Lots of kids, you know, and just a situation that worked out for her. So I would suggest to students, just don't be, just because maybe there's a slightly larger increase in pay with a company, at a bio, you know, with a biotech or pharma company, or any company, it doesn't mean, money is not a motivating factor. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of studies that tell that, you know, yeah, we all have to have certain necessities met, but, you know, if you're making $100,000 and somebody offers you $110,000, and you think, wow, that's a lot more money, what do I do with that? Within 3 months, you won't remember that you're making more money. You'll mm-hmm. just be griping about the same old stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of stories of people who don't make nearly as much money as maybe they could, but yet they're working in a team or they're working on a project that they really feel, you know, passion for. Mm-hmm. And so I would suggest to students to try to do a postdoc in industry. Try to do some, get into some sort of program. If you're a scientist and you want to get into business, you know, try some sort of summer internship. J.P. Morgan, I don't know off the top of my head who would have these specifically, but I know they exist. I tell the students in my class back at Jefferson, and a lot of them said, I want to be a consultant. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you guys are like 28. You know, what are you going to consult about? You know, you haven't spent a lot of time, you know, learning a skill set that you could then consult and share with other people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are a lot of consulting firms that like to pick up people right out of school. And so apply to one of their programs. Don't apply for a full-blown job. You might get there and hate it. You might realize working 80 hours a week and traveling 2.5 weeks a month isn't really all that fun.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Just because, I mean, it's fun initially, but maybe it gets old just because you're making a better increase in salary. So I think people should test things when they can, if it's available.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing what you want, I mean, you know, and being able to communicate that, and it goes both ways. I mean, if you're a student, if you're a postdoc, if you're looking at advisors, you know, and you have this inclination maybe to jump into some sort of business role down the road, or get out of academics down the road, you might not be suited picking the person who has no connections outside of his or her department or his or her sort of space.
Right.
You know, measuring some sort of phosphorylation event on some sort of weird protein that nobody really knows about. He's done 3 posters wrong and nobody shows up for. You know, that would be tough. You know, I think it goes both ways. You know, it's not just like blaming the advisors, you know. You have to take ownership as a student, as anybody, for where you're going and where you're headed. And in that way, when you get there and you don't like it, you have nobody to blame but yourself.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree.
I do that.
Yeah, having that experience, I mean, I think that's what a postdoc is essentially there for. It doesn't necessarily need to be in academia, although most of them tend to be in academia. You have opportunities to do that in industry as well, or take on some kind of internship role at a tech transfer office, or in some kind of, angel investor group, something like that, more of an internship shadowing program. But something else I've seen the folks at MCW do, and I know you have some insight into this, is the PICO group, the postdocs an industry consultants group that they formed. I think that's another great outlet for postdocs that are in academia to get some industry experiences, to start an organization like this and kind of pitch this idea to some of the startups or some of the biotech companies that maybe need some of the experience that these postdocs do have. And I think that program at MCW has grown, it's doubled in just 1 year. So they're doing something right.
That program should be franchised and should be next to every Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks across the country.
Mm-hmm.
That program makes a lot of sense to me because, one, it speaks to a little bit of what I just thought about. You know,
sure.
Geez, if you're, you know, you test something out. So you go into a small company and maybe you love it. Or maybe you taste it and you go, Jesus, God, look at business development. I'm telling you, this sucks. I'm out of here. Fine, perfect. You figured it out. I mean, that's half the battle, is figuring out what we don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it really makes a lot of sense because from the company's perspective, like Prometheus, we've had a great interaction with at least 4 postdocs, I think, we're up mm-hmm. to now. Right, Adam and Sheldon and Mindy and Brian Hoffman. And we really, I like working with them. I mean, I just enjoy it because, you know, it's sort of paying it back. I think mm-hmm. people did it for me, and I just enjoy helping people figure things out what they want to do. It doesn't cost us anything. You know, it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sometimes you get what you pay for, yeah. although we've had a great experience, but you're telling me as somebody who, you know, runs a company that I can get an extra pair of hands or, you know, two pairs of hands for free.
Yeah.
And I can give them a project and, you know, I can interview the people that I want and don't want and, you know, who would fit on our team and, mm-hmm. you know, wow, sign me up. And I think that there are so many places. And again, I have this relationship back in Philadelphia with Jefferson, there mm-hmm. are huge places, incubator stations, whatever you want to call them, the research centers,
right.
where there's 15, 20, 30 small companies like a Fermentis,
mm-hmm.
you know, all around the water cooler. And I can guarantee you, if you went to all of those companies, I would expect 100% of those companies yep. would say, yeah, yep. yeah, I'll take somebody on.
Sure.
No risk to me, mm-hmm. no insurance, no overhead costs, no salary.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to come in and work on something that I've been thinking about in the back of my mind, but I've never really had enough time to think about fully, so I won't get to it. I mean, everybody has a dry erase board that's got two or three items on it that you'll just never get to,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so that's what this is perfect for, and it gives them the right experience.
Yeah.
It gives them an exposure. And you know what it does? Like the guys and Mindy, the group, I call everybody guys, and I apologize.
Mm-hmm.
But the folks who've come into Prementis, we're LinkedIn on LinkedIn. We're networking with, you know, if you need something, hey, I don't know that person over at that company, but I know somebody who does, and let me help you.
Sure.
Again, it's the currency that you're now a student, and that program provides the best opportunity mm-hmm. to network.
Yeah,
I think it's that.
Yeah, I completely agree.
But think of it. I mean, Cambridge, San Francisco, San Diego. I mean, mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, it works in Milwaukee. There are incubator sort of spin out, areas where these companies are. I don't understand why it's not on every street corner in America.
Yeah.
Wherever there's a college.
Soon enough. I have one final question for you. Again, taking into consideration all the experience that you've had so far and all the training you've had so far, in simple terms, how would you define what would be the value of having a PhD?
Oof. You know, I know you're asking about a PhD, and I've explained this to a few of my friends about the MBA. They're like, oh, that's pretty cool, you know, you did that. And it's like, dude, you know, you don't need to have an MBA for much of anything unless mm-hmm. you're on Wall Street. You know, I think it's useful there.
Right.
You go to have an MBA. I could be doing my job just fine without my MBA because mm-hmm. I have all of these sort of diverse
right.
experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no substitute for experience. So if you go and you get an MBA or you have whatever degree and you don't also collect relevant, useful, and appropriate experience, then that degree is probably not really worth much.
Right.
So I think that, for example, the MBA, I think I'd still be sitting here talking to you. I think I'd still be sitting here working with Prementis. I think it's kind of cool on my resume to have, and I would do it all over again because I met some fabulous people in the program,
mm-hmm.
because they expose you to other companies. Because they're trying to network you in like the PICO program. They're trying to get you access to, in this case, mostly businesses.
Right.
The program that I did was at Rutgers, and it had a focus on pharmaceutical management.
Mm-hmm.
So, another currency of this program was that they pushed us and interacted with, I think at the time, with Johnson & Johnson. I remember going over to their campus and attending seminars. We had a relationship, I think, with BMS as well, where, you know, you might spend a social hour, you know, dealing and interacting with people at these companies
sure.
because they had a relationship with Rutgers in the program. So they were trying to force you into these interactions and network, and I think that's really, the experience is what is important. Now, it's hard to run a scientific company. It's hard to do science without at least spending some time in the lab and doing science. The PhD is how we, it's our membership card. It's how we, typically that somebody has gone through and understands the scientific process, mm-hmm. can design things. I think it was just, like you said, it's the membership card of, hey, I'm independent. I can look at a data set, and I don't need my PI over my shoulder interpreting mm-hmm. my results for me.
Right.
I sat down, designed the experiments, and, oh, hey, Jeff, this is what we got. Check it out. Mm-hmm. Here's what I think's going on. Here's what I think's the next step. And that, it just comes with the territory. So I don't know. It's hard to run a science company or do science without a PhD in science.
Mm-hmm.
Not impossible, but it certainly helps. So I think from that perspective, it's been very valuable in helping me look at data and interpret data.
Sure.
Right? It's sort of like going to law school, and you get that mindset of, well, let me look at the worst case scenario here, because that's I think that's what they teach in law school is the worst case scenario of things. And I think getting a PhD, they're really training you to think. To design an experiment, to think about the controls, to think about the data, and think about what a graph could be interpreted as. Maybe it means this, but hey, look, it could mean this too, guys. Think about that. And so I think it's been very useful. It's been very fun, and I would I'd probably go to medical school if I had to do it all over again. No, I'm just kidding. but no, it's I don't know the better. I don't know how else to answer that question.
Okay. Yeah, that was great. I mean, I think you've provided significant insight into, your background, your experience, and what one must really take into consideration as they're transitioning, especially outside of academia and industry. But, you mentioned always to kind of be in motion, to be prepared. It's not necessarily always about luck, but some of it has to do with luck. And I think the more you increase your network, the more likely it's going to be the higher your probability is going to be to find something that best suits you in a field that you're interested in. And again, experience is, you can't discount the experience. So, I completely agree that having these, these interactions with individuals outside of your lab and outside of your close bubble network is going to be extremely important as people are moving forward. Again, I really appreciate you coming on and going through this and kind of answering some of these questions. It's been extremely enlightening, and I would encourage anybody to check out the company that Chad is working with right now. It's Promentis Pharma. You can find them at www.promentispharma.com. And I also wanted to mention Chad's also a co-founder of a journal called Technology Transfer and Entrepreneurship. So I would encourage listeners to also check that out as well. It seems like a very interesting journal related to people interested in the business side of the business side of academic science. So, again, Chad, I appreciate you coming on and answering all these questions. I look forward to interacting with you again in the future.
Well, cool, Brian. I appreciate the time, and I would just add a little footnote to the Tech Transfer Journal. Our first issue comes out next year, so you won't find a whole. We do have a website, but we're working with Bentham Science, and so we're going to be in their stable of journals. But the first issue, Volume 1, Issue 1, doesn't come out until January of 2014. So it's kind of what I said. It's the business of doing science in articles. Written towards that mission, but we're also focused on students as well and mentorship. We're going to have an entire issue devoted to and articles written from postdocs and graduate students. So it should be hopefully a lot of fun.
That's great.
But this, I thank you for your time. Thank you for the questions, and I love talking about this stuff. So give me a call at some point down the road.
Sure. All right. Thanks very much, Chad. I appreciate it.
Well,
I
search you out.
Cool.
Right, thanks, Mark.
Take care. In every face on the crowd and crooked blue streets. I don't know how you put the ache in me. And I confess, I think it's natural. I slept in Memphis and woke up in